Welcome to the Living Waters Church Podcast.
Good morning. If you're in the lobby, I'm going to invite you to come on in and grab a seat. We're going to get started together. I'm going to continue through the Gospel of Luke, as Dave mentioned. If you noticed, in December, we spent some time there, and then in January, our prayer series was rooted out of Luke chapter 2, and we're going to continue on through the Gospel of Luke in 2019. But before we do that, just want to show you one more thing that we talked about. Today, our new bulletins come out for the month. So this is February's bulletin, and if you open up, you'll notice inside, and if you don't have one with you, maybe grab one on the way out, something that says towards the bottom of the first page, Living Waters Social Justice. We have a wonderful group of people that think about, pray about, and help us move towards areas of service when it comes to social justice as a part of who we are as a church community. And over the past few years, that's looked like different things. One of the main ways that social justice gets expressed at Living Waters is through financial giving. So you notice that around, especially in December, when we give all that money away, that gets talked about and discussed and poured over by that social justice team. But in the past year, as Dave's come on, he's lent really great help and work with that team, and they've been able to move a few things forward. And so you might not necessarily be aware, but there are five areas of social justice emphasis that we consider as a church community together, and that's homelessness, the elderly, newcomers to Canada, human trafficking, and people who would be considered to be vulnerable people. And what we're going to be doing throughout the year is highlighting some of those areas and directing you in ways that you can get connected further. So you can visit our website, lwchurch.ca, and you'll find more information there about how to get involved with some of these areas. But you can also find out more in things like our monthly bulletin. So today we're highlighting actually the concerns of homelessness in our community. You can read more about that online. But we also want to highlight something going on with the Gateway of Hope called the Coldest Night of the Year. I was a part of this last year with Sarah and a few other folks from our community, and it's a great event to come together if you're not connected yet with the place, the Gateway of Hope, that is run by the Salvation Army, to consider the issue of homelessness and what we might do to be a part of it. We have a wonderful group of people that serve on a Saturday there, which is great, but this is a one-time opportunity on February 23rd. It's coming up, and the Gateway is looking to raise some money, and I took this screenshot a few days ago, and so they're well underway of meeting their goal, but they need some more help. And so if you're interested in being a part of the event, it's really quite simple. We walk around Langley. You come together and meet at the Gateway. You can do a 2-kilometer walk, a 5-kilometer walk, or a 10-kilometer walk on that night. It's totally family friendly. You get a super cool toque and chili at the end. And it's a chance just to pledge some money to do a walk and to say, we do see those who don't have somewhere to live in our community. We're not blind to it. God's not blind to it. And we want to do something about it. So just to let you know that that is coming up on February 23rd, and we'd love to see you be there. Sarah and I are going to be there. We're looking forward to it. And just thanks to Dave and to our social justice team, who's done really, really good work to help us find ways to connect more so in our community. So that's coming up, just to let you know about it. So we're in the Gospel of Luke, and you're going to notice, if you're newer, that because we really value variations of perspective and variations of experience, you're going to have a team approach to as we walk through the Gospel of Luke together. We have a speaking team, and you're going to hear a number of voices in our different locations. You're going to hear men and women, and we're looking forward to learning from one another. And it was so good last week to hear from Rebecca. I thought she did a fantastic job in helping us unpack more about prayer. But today we're going to move further into the Gospel of Luke and see what Jesus is up to and where he's taking us and see what we can learn from him today and where God might be leading us today through this story. So this is Luke chapter 2, verses 39 through 52. Let me read this for us. When Jesus' parents had fulfilled all the requirements of the law, they returned home to Nazareth in Galilee. And there the child grew up healthy and strong. He was filled with wisdom, and God's favor was on him. Every year Jesus' parents went to Jerusalem for the Passover festival. When Jesus was 12 years old, they attended the festival as usual, and after the celebration was over, they started home to Nazareth, but Jesus stayed behind in Jerusalem. His parents didn't miss him at first because they assumed he was among the other relatives, but when he didn't show up that evening, they started looking for him among their relatives and friends. When they couldn't find him, they went back to Jerusalem to search for him there. 3 days later, they finally discovered him in the temple, sitting among the religious leaders, listening to them and asking questions. All who heard him were amazed at his understanding and his answers. His parents didn't know what to think. "Son," his mother said to him, "why have you done this to us? Your father and I have been frantic, searching for you everywhere." "But why did you need to search?" he asked. "Didn't you know that I must be in my father's house?" But they didn't understand what he meant. Then he returned to Nazareth with them and was obedient to them. And his mother stored all these things in her heart. Jesus grew in wisdom and in stature and in favor with God and all the people. I think this is probably one of those stories that sparks our imagination and stirs up maybe even some memories of our own. Memories of when we were little, disappeared on our parents. Or experiences that we've had of when we've turned around a grocery store or in a park and gone, "Oh dear, where are they?" I know it reminds me of stories of when I was a child and doing that to my parents. I remember one particular time when I was going to visit my friend's house, and I was explicitly told, you can go to your friend's house, but the two of you can't go to the ravine. And the ravine was a place in behind our school, and it was a very interesting place for 8-year-old boys to go, because we weren't supposed to go there. And there was all kinds of stories about things that would happen down there, and who might be living down there, and we thought that we should go and check it out. And so we did. My friend and I went down there, into the ravine. I ended up tearing up my leg and got all bloody and needed stitches and was walking home with my bike when my mom came by in the station wagon and said, "Didn't I tell you not to go to the ravine? This is what happens when you disobey me." And that stays with me. So maybe you have a story like that that you remember where that's happened. In a way, this story runs a little bit along those lines in that it seems to be about disobedience, but not in the kind of way that we might have experienced or imagined ourselves with our children or in our own childhood. I think considering all the stories that we have about Jesus, if we were to select maybe the top 10 strangest episodes, a really good argument could be made for this story ending up on the list. First, it's singular to Luke. So we don't find it in Matthew or Mark or John. Second, it's the only story that we have about Jesus' childhood in the Gospels. And third, it's a little bit out of left field, because we might expect a story about Jesus' childhood to be about how he was always nice to the other children or how he always cleaned his room, something like that. Instead, at first reading, it almost seems like Luke is casting Jesus as a cheeky, holier-than-thou preteen. So is this Jesus on a learning curve? Is this Jesus about to enter his terrible teens? Why does Luke include this story? Part of the reason that we find this story is because Luke's investigation has turned it up. Luke, he tells us early on in the story, has interviewed eyewitnesses, he's done his homework. He's a good first century journalist, and we do really get the feeling that Luke's had some contact with Jesus' family in the first few chapters, given the detail that we're getting from him, all kinds of detail, information that almost seems as if it's being shared from Mary's perspective. But as a biographer, Luke is also telling us a carefully crafted story, an intentional story. So what we have is not only some good first century investigatory journalism, but a story with a slant, a story with a point, something that's saying something. And that's exactly how we still tell stories today. It's how we write and read biography today. If we were to pick up a biography of Emily Carr or Nelson Mandela or Terry Fox, we find an arranged story told from a point of view, with a perspective, and it depicts the character in a very particular light. So that's what's going on here. Luke is showing us Jesus in a particular light. So what light is Jesus in? What picture are we being given? where we're told that Jesus, after the Passover festival, he stays behind, and he's finally found in the temple after this frantic search with his parents. Now, forgetting your 12-year-old in another city might sound like awful parenting, and it probably would be in this day and age. Kind of a weird first century version of Home Alone is what this reads a little bit like sometimes to me. But this is actually the unremarkable part of the story. According to Jewish custom, Jesus is really considered to be virtually a man at this point. His parents have probably been traveling with extended family and friends. All of Nazareth, much of Nazareth, have poured out along with the other surrounding areas, all moving to Jerusalem consistently for the festivals, of which there would have been 3 or 4 each year. They're there at Passover, and thousands of people are coming in and out. Mary and Joseph probably, as we lead later on in the Gospels, have other children at this point, and their firstborn is expected to be in and around other trusted family members, kind of in the group, in the caravan. And it's only at evening that they realize he's not there. So the expectation that Jesus would be around is probably something like expecting the eldest in a family today to be capable of making it home from school by themselves or cleaning their room and things kind of like that. Eventually, Mary and Joseph realize that Jesus isn't around, and they go back to find him. The remarkable part of the story is not that Jesus goes missing, but where his parents find him, and what they find him doing, and then how he responds to their concerns about his disappearance. First, where is Jesus and what is he doing? Well, Luke tells us that he's in the temple, and he's in dialogue with the most educated people in Jerusalem. He's schooling the schoolers. People are amazed at his insight already. So Luke is telling us that Jesus is someone already at age 12 with a strange authority and wisdom. Not only this, he's showing us Jesus in the temple. He's showing us Jesus in a particular place for a reason. And the next and the last time that Luke is going to show us Jesus in the temple is at the very end of Jesus' life, which is what the Gospel of Luke all builds towards. And at that moment, towards the end of Jesus' life, Jesus causes quite a commotion, and that sets him on track to ultimately being plotted against and killed. So both episodes in the temple that Luke is showing us, at the beginning of his life and at the end of his life, portray Jesus in something of what we might say is an uncontrollable light. An uncontrollable light. Luke is showing us someone who is unlike the other characters around him. And this unlikeness is all part of the story that Luke is crafting. And if somehow unexpectedly and mysteriously Jesus is Israel's God, come to live amongst them, this scene puts Jesus exactly where you'd expect to find God, or where Israel hoped to find God, in the temple. Come back, finally, in the very center of Jewish life, leading Israel's teachers and leaders. And that in itself is a bit of a haunting and a startling image. Do those around Jesus even understand who he is and what's going on? Second, how do they find Jesus? And how does he respond to his parents in that moment? They turn up and effectively say, "We were worried sick. We're looking for you everywhere. Don't you understand how family works?" Essentially, Jesus replies, "Is it a big surprise to find me in my Father's house?" Some translations say, "focused on my Father's work." And in behind those words is this foreshadowing of what we discover throughout Luke's biography of Jesus. It's as if Jesus is saying, "Don't you remember that I have other family, another allegiance, a deeper loyalty?" And that's really the crux of the story. That's the moment that maybe causes us to step back a little bit as the reader, as we see this drama unfold. One of the themes of Luke's gospel surrounds the question of loyalty and disloyalty, of rebellion and compliance. And at different points in the gospels, and this is one of those moments, Jesus surprises people with kind of a stark response, and sometimes it puts people's noses out of joint. it causes them to stumble back a little bit. And just to be clear, this isn't Jesus being a brat just for the sake of it. We're talking this week in the office, and Nick McAllister said, I grew up believing that this story was about the only time that Jesus sinned. And I had to get my head around that. That's not necessarily what's going on here, since at the end of the episode, we're told that Jesus returns home with his parents and he's obedient to them. So this isn't a story about the only time Jesus sinned. But oftentimes, Jesus does something that others don't expect him to do, and that sets them back a little bit. People often expect Jesus to do this or that, and he does the other. People expect Jesus to stay with them, and he goes. They expect Jesus to go, and he stays, as in the story with Lazarus. But it becomes clear, and this scene is an early indicator, that Jesus is getting his marching orders from elsewhere. He's not obstinate or rude, but almost, you could say, distracted and determined. There's a sense, and this is the best word I think we might have for this, there's a sense that Jesus is preoccupied with matters that others around him aren't necessarily tuned into. With Israel's story in mind, this is also one of those episodes, as we see it in Mark's gospel, in which we're faced with Jesus' paramount kind of interest in the elsewhere. His devotion to God overshadows really any other master. And Jesus, Luke's showing us here, with Israel's story in mind, is being cast as the child Israel hasn't been to God. He's attentive, he's trusting, he's obedient. Unlike Israel has been throughout in our readings of the Old Testament, Jesus in this moment is filling the shoes, or beginning to fill the shoes, that Israel hasn't filled. And there's a further hint of how Jesus refers to God, isn't there? He says, "Didn't you know that I would be found in my Father's house?" Israelites would sometimes use the plural "our Father" for God. But Jesus says, "my Father." And it's really something only Jesus does. It's unparalleled. So the story asks, who does Jesus listen to? Only God. What way is Jesus going? Only God's way. And this is one of the ways in which we see God's character in Jesus also, and we're going to see it throughout Luke's gospel. He's always reflecting God's nature. He's always going God's way, doing things as God would do them into the world, constantly being that. And that is sometimes shocking to the world, sometimes different than we might expect. Here is someone who is truly willing to call God Father and really follow through on all that means. Someone who really trusts and then is able to really reflect God's character into the world. And so what's meant to come through this story is really this startling contrast between how preoccupied Jesus is with the one he calls Father before anyone else. How and what, when push really comes to shove, is Jesus really tuned into? And that becomes challenging at different points in the Gospels for the people who are around Jesus, even for people that we would say, Mary and Joseph for this instance, who know Jesus the best. This is their child, their son. In this story, Mary virtually scolds Jesus, doesn't she? Because of his preoccupation. His preoccupation has caused them problems and inconvenience. And Luke says that his parents, when Jesus responds to them, simply didn't understand what was going on. So here's a moment in which their ideas about who Jesus is and how he should go about things get toppled over. They've been part of his story from the start, but Jesus is already breaking out of even his parents' expectations. They don't know what to think about it. And as a reader, we're kind of just left hanging. Their framework is being challenged. Their boxes and their questions, they're not easily answered. And Luke simply says, as he does earlier in chapter 2, that Mary stores up or treasures up these things and just ponders them in her heart. What a dramatic picture for people who call themselves Jesus followers. I think the story asks us really a couple of questions. The first question this story asks is, are we prepared for God to outgrow us? Are we prepared for God to outgrow us? Sooner or later, like Mary, and if we've been following Jesus for any amount of time, we might find ourselves asking, what do you think you're doing, God? Don't you realize the trouble that you're causing me? The inconvenience? Maybe that has to do with God not checking the boxes that we expect God to check. Maybe that has to do with a prayer being answered or not being answered in a way that we expected it to be prayed or answered. Or even, maybe it has to do with, if we're totally honest, feeling like God has disappointed or even disappeared on us. And it gets very frustrating, very fast in the life of a Christian, if we're expecting to do the leading and the guiding rather than being led and guided. Part of growing up in faith means that when we sign up with Jesus, we are signing up, whether we know it or not, for more than we've bargained for. More than we've bargained for. We're getting to know someone unlike ourselves. Someone trustworthy, but uncontrollable, which can at times, from our point of view, feel pretty darn inconvenient, can it? And that reminds me a little bit of The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and that wonderful conversation between Susan and the beaver. And those of you that know the story are tracking with me. Those of you that you don't, go, why is a woman named Susan speaking to a beaver? But anyway, go and read it. It's fantastic. And they're talking about Aslan, the lion, who C.S. Lewis writes as a representation of God. It's an allegory to an extent. And in this conversation between Susan and the beaver, she says, well, a lion concerns me. Is he safe? And the beaver says, oh, no, he's not safe. He's not tame, but he is good. That sense that we need to learn to trust who is trustworthy, but not put our hands on him in control, is what it is to grow in our faith. And that means that things are going to deepen with God as we grow with God. They're not going to get shallower. Things are going to get deeper, not shallower. Our understanding, our trust, our view is going to need to widen, to expand, to deepen also, if we're going to grow. I came across this cartoon this week from The New Yorker, which I thought was pretty good. Two astronauts, they've finally made it to the moon. They've set up, they sit down in the lawn chairs, they hang up a wind chime, and one says to the other, I bet you feel pretty ridiculous bringing that wind chime. In a way, that touches a little bit on what's going on in this story. We get somewhere, we arrive there, we're expecting one kind of thing, and all of a sudden, it's not as we expected. It's bigger, it's more. Our presuppositions about how this life with Christ is going to unfold shift, not based on us, but based on our experience of a widening and a deepening God. So there's both, I think, real challenge, but also real comfort in this story. If we're experiencing the unexpected, maybe even the inconvenient with God, it doesn't necessarily mean that something's wrong or that we've done something wrong. It might just mean that things are getting deeper, that we're being drawn into deeper places, that we're finding ourselves now on a different planet. The question is, what are we going to do with God when he begins to outgrow our understanding? And maybe a good place to begin, even in our lack of understanding, is to be like Mary and gather up and ponder these things in our hearts, sit in them for a while, and just learn to grow. And sometimes really, when we're facing things that we don't expect with God, that's the only natural response, just to ponder, just to treasure, just to sit with him. And then after years and then decades, all of a sudden we find ourselves a person of wisdom, a person of depth with God. As someone said in our office this week, that's why we have wise grandmothers. They've learned just to sit and to ponder, to reflect, to grow. The second question is, and this is more with Jesus' example maybe in mind, what are we, as Jesus' followers, preoccupied with? What are we, as Jesus' followers, preoccupied with? Another way of asking that question might be, what frequency are we tuned into? And that's really one of the main questions, I think, that we face as Christians. At every turn, we find a choice to either go God's way or go another way. What controls and guides us? What whispers into our ears? What, even good things upon reflection, need to take a back seat? Who or what, in the end, are we really going to call Father? And Jesus' example is a great one to follow. Jesus' example says, nothing is getting in between me and my Father. Nothing is going to control me, direct me, guide me, other than God. Wherever we find ourselves then, we're preoccupied as followers of Jesus if we're going his way. Preoccupied or tuning into our Father's voice, getting on with our Father's work. So thinking on this story, and if we can hear this rightly, I wonder, a little piece of encouragement that we could share with one another is to remember that in following Jesus, it might be time to begin to exercise a little more Jesus-like disobedience. A little more preoccupation with God. And that's why we started the 2019 with the series on prayer that we did. It's why we listen to St. Paul when he says to the first Christians, never stop praying. Never cease praying. Always be preoccupied, be mindful, be tuned in, so to speak. And that's one way that we can be preoccupied with God and listening to God's voice. Being aware, being drawn into deeper things that others might not necessarily be aware of. One of the best things that I've heard said about prayer is from Eugene Peterson, where he said, prayer gets us in on what God is doing. Prayer gets us in on what God is doing. So prayer is a part of walking in that preoccupation of what God is up to, being preoccupied with what God's preoccupied with. And that's one way, but another way is to be active and engaged and to be listening to what God's up to and to be mindful of the things that we can be involved in. And it's actually why we share things like we just have about the coldest night of the year through the Salvation Army. Is God aware? Is God attentive? Is God concerned with the problem of homelessness in Langley and the surrounding area? Are God's followers aware, concerned, involved with that issue of homelessness in Langley and the surrounding area? And so part of coming together in those kind of communal moments is to say we're preoccupied with what God's preoccupied with. We're paying attention to. We're giving our time, our energy, our resources to the things that we know Jesus would have us do. Prayer and action points. That's why we share those things with you to be a part of it. What is God preoccupied with? Can we stand and pray as we conclude? Gracious Lord, thank you that you draw us into deeper places. And some of us are here in the room right now who are feeling out of their depth. We're feeling like we're treading a little bit of water. But at the same time, we feel that you're drawing us deeper. Pray that you give us the grace and the capacity to trust you and to know you in deeper ways than we have before. Even those of us who are sitting here in pain and suffering, Lord, would you show us through the cross, through your love, how life can come out of that. And Jesus, we ask that you would continue to shape and renovate our hearts so that we can be tuned in and be preoccupied and dedicated to the things that you're preoccupied and dedicated to and with. Lord, would you continually shape and soften us to be mindful of those around us who have not all that much? Would you continue to help us to reflect into the world as Jesus has who you are and what you're all about? We pray these things in Jesus' name. Everyone said, amen. Bless you. Have a great rest of your Sunday. Try and catch a snowflake on your tongue on your way out.